Well, again, good morning. Thank you for coming. As usual, we have our announcements. Next Saturday, the 9th, will be Save a Saturday for February. Let's have a great turnout again, as we did for January. So much needed work gets done when you show up. We need your commitment to our success here. Come and stay as long as you can. It's from 10 a.m. To 2 p.m., but that you certainly don't have to stay this whole 4 hours. Just come for an hour, and if you're here at lunchtime, lunch will be served at 12:30, and we normally get very delicious vegetarian pizza from Mellow Mushroom. So come for that. And those of you who've been coming pretty regularly for the Save a Saturdays may recall that we also recite the Chandi hymns in English from 10 to 10:30 on that Saturday morning. So normally they're, most Saturdays and Tuesdays are recited about 7 a.m., so that's a little early for most people, but so that people can come on Save a Saturday, they're recited it from 10 to 10:30. Next Sunday, speaking of the Chandi, we have, I'm very pleased to say, Swami Hari Namanandaji, the resident minister at the San Diego Vedanta Center, San Diego Vedanta Society, and he'll speak to us on decoding the Chandi. And here's what he says about this. We will take a journey into this popular text, the Devi Mahatmyam, the glory of the goddess, go through the three stories of the Chandi, discover their meanings, and understand the importance within our own lives as spiritual aspirants. Reading and understanding the glories of the Divine Mother is a great spiritual practice which can awaken and illumine our inner consciousness and give us strength to face the inevitable obstacles of life. And a whole talk could be given on just that last sentence, awaken our own inner consciousness and give us strength to face the inevitable obstacles of life. And that will probably be a great part of what the Swami speaks about on next Sunday. So please come for the Swami's talk. And then stay for the reception and potluck lunch that follows, because he's going away almost immediately. We won't have time to have a potluck lunch that evening, and to ask you to come early in the morning and then come again in the evening doesn't make sense anyway. So we're just going to have our reception and potluck lunch immediately after his talk. So that'll be very pleasant. And of course, the Swami talks during lunch. Anybody who asks him a question, he talks, and he'll talk loud enough for everyone to hear. On the 17th of this month, Swami Brahmananda's birthday celebration, we had Swamiji's last weekend. Normally, we would follow that by Brahmananda's on the 10th, but since Hari Namananda was going to be on the East Coast, he said, could he come on the 10th? And he'll make some few remarks about Brahmananda, telling us some things that aren't in the books. But then I said, sure, we'll just move the puja to the next week. So we'll, as usual, have a short talk on that morning, followed by puja with Aditya as our pujari. Afterward, we'll share our potluck lunch in the monastery. Shrine decoration begins at 10 a.m., followed by the talk and worship at 11, then our potluck prasad lunch at 12:30. If you're bringing food to offer, please have it here no later than 11 a.m. As always, we need you to volunteer. You can help with puja prep or serve in the kitchen. Puja assistants, please be here by 9:30 a.m. Kitchen people by 10:30 a.m. So that's it for the announcements, unless there's something I've forgotten. Okay. Well, then we'll start with our regular opening chant, which reestablishes our purpose here and our relationship to the divine being. Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahano Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Now, a choir is forming. Aditya is kind of taking the lead on that, but they haven't prepared a song for this morning, and since this is going to be a longish kind of talk, I won't sing one for you, which tries your patience anyway. But in any event, welcome again, and our topic this morning is John Dobson's Equations of Maya. Now, because this is from a paper that John Dobson delivered at the first anniversary of the World's Parliament of Religions in 1893, this is going to be more of a reading than usual. There's some interpolations, of course, as we go along, but basically, this is John constructed quite an argument about the equations of Maya. The paper is much longer than what I'll present this morning. These are excerpts. And we will post the whole thing online when we post the talk along with these notes. We'll post the link to the whole thing. So you'll be able to read the whole thing if you wish. It's quite an exercise, mental exercise, let me tell you, because he really leads us through a very well thought out discussion and dissertation on his topic. So, John Dobson's Equations of Maya. We start this month. This is not yet John. I'll tell you what it is. We start this month with study of Bhakti Yoga. As a Bhakti Yogi, a Bhakta, you establish a devotional relationship with God through study, prayer, ritual, and worship. You practice giving every action, thought, emotion, perception, and tendency a Godward turn. All your energies and attributes, both positive and negative, are offered to the Divine Presence. Your prayer is for self-surrender, union with your Beloved. And this morning, we'll see how we can approach an analysis of Maya as a Bhakta. John Dobson, who was an astronomer, student of human history, and Vedanta philosopher, wrote, and now this begins John, "Modern cosmologists usually take non-existence for granted and hope to get the universe out of nothing. But we must assume..." Oh, he had a button. He had a button that he would give everyone. It said, "Nothing doesn't exist." Just think about it. Nothing doesn't exist. "Modern cosmologists usually take non-existence for granted and hope to get the universe out of nothing. But must we assume that in the absence of the universe and in the absence of space and time, there would be nothing? Or can we, without so rash an assumption, find clues to what might remain if instead we take existence for granted but leave out space and time? Could what remains through apparition or Maya appear as this universe? Can we, from what remains, get a universe of gravity, electricity, and inertia?" And then an interpolation. "If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Albert Einstein. If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Dobson was a master of explaining Advaita Vedanta simply. This morning we will explore and discuss his detailed yet very clear descriptions of how Brahman appears to us as this universe. And then another quote, this time from Vivekananda. There cannot be two existences, only one. There cannot be two existences, only one. Swamiji's remark is a clue about how to see what we're about to hear from a bhakta's perspective. The bhakta sees all of existence, however it may be perceived, as a manifestation of God's glory, a reason for awe, reverence, devotion, and selflessness. We understand, as Sri Ramakrishna said, that as a bhakta, that as God draws us near to him through our devotion and our reverence, our prayer, our japam, all of the things that go along with being a bhakta, as God draws us near to us, all our misperceptions, all of our perceptions are dissolved, and there is this union with the beloved in first one great thought and then no thought at all, as described by both Narada and his Bhakti Sutras and by Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras. So just as an introduction to what John wrote, Dobson wrote The Equations of Maya as a talk for the 100th anniversary of the 1893 Parliament of Religions, at which Swami Vivekananda so eloquently proclaimed that all religions are true, and that the proof of one is the proof of all. Dobson asked, quote, "Can we by now also square science with religion? In particular, can we square relativity and quantum mechanics with Swami Vivekananda's Advaita Vedanta? Since there cannot be two worlds, one for the scientists and one for the mystics, it must be that their descriptions are of the same world, but from different points of view. Can we, from the vantage point of the Swami's Advaita, non-dualism, see both points of view?" Swami Vivekananda said that science and religion would meet and shake hands. Can we see things from that vantage point? Since the notion of Maya, or apparition, as the first cause of our physics is central to the Swami's Advaita, I have chosen as my subject the equations of Maya. Can we find them in our physics, according to the philosophy of the Advaita Vedantins? As the Swami himself has said, there cannot be two existences, only one. And Maya is, as it were, a veil or screen through which that oneness, the absolute, is seen as this universe of plurality and change. Maya is, as it were, a veil or screen through which that oneness is seen as this universe of plurality and change. To discuss the equations of Maya, first, we have to know what equations are. Second, we have to know what the Vedantins meant by Maya. And finally, we have to take a hard look at our physics to see if any of our equations can be taken as descriptive of Maya. What are equations? They are a kind of mathematical shorthand. They are just brief statements, usually in symbolic form, like the numeral 2, plus sign, numeral 2, equals sign, the numeral 4. If you put that in English, it reads 2 plus 2 equals 4. There's nothing scary about it. But essentially, there are two kinds of equations, mathematical equations like the one just mentioned, and the equations of our physics. But mathematics is not about anything. Two oranges plus two oranges equals four oranges is about oranges. But two plus two equals four is not about anything. Now, physics is about something. It is about how matter behaves. So the equations of physics are about the behavior of matter, and that's what concerns us here. Newton's famous equation, F equals ma, put into words, means that the force required to accelerate an object is proportional to the product of the mass of that object and the rate of change of its velocity, F equals ma. That means that when you're pushing a car to speed it up, how hard you have to push depends on how heavy the car is and how fast you have to speed it up. And that is contained in that little statement, F equals ma. It's just a kind of shorthand. What is Maya? We've talked a little about equations, now we have to talk about Maya. What do the Vedantins mean by Maya? First, we know from the Upanishads that it, Maya, is made of three gunas, tamas, rajas, and sattva. Tamas has its veiling power, rajas has its projecting power, and sattva has its revealing power. Now, this language, veiling and revealing, is the language of perception, not the language of manufacture. Very important point. I'm going to repeat that. Tamas has its veiling power, rajas has its projecting power, and sattva has its revealing power. Now, this language, veiling and revealing, is the language of perception, not the language of manufacture. You can't make anything out of a guna, as the Sankhyans wanted to do. These three gunas, of which Maya is said to be made, are just three aspects of misperception. This is so key for us now as we go ahead. Please keep this in mind. The gunas are the instruments of Mother's creation of our misperception, the game of blind man's buff that she's playing with us, blind man's bluff. As Sri Ramakrishna said, Mother tells us, go enjoy the world with a sign of her eye. Go enjoy this world of misperception. These three gunas of which Maya is said to be made are just three aspects of a misperception. They are not substances like wood, stone, or gold out of which objects could be made. They are simply three aspects of an apparition. And the reason that that John mentions wood, stone, or gold is those are examples that are used in the Sankhyans formulation of transformational causation. This is wood and this is in that form. This is wood in another form. The tree is wood in its primal form. All wood transformed into various forms of wood and gold and stone and so on. And so John is deliberately taking the Vedantin's attitude, Swami Vivekananda's attitude, that this is a misperception, that the gunas are not, they don't make anything, they make us see things as if they are made when they are not. So back to John. In order to mistake a rope for a snake, you must fail to see the rope rightly. That's the veiling power of tamas. You must jump to the wrong conclusion. That is the projecting power of rajas. You yourself project the snake. but the length and diameter of the rope are seen as the length and diameter of the snake. That's the revealing power of Sattva. If you hadn't seen the rope, you might have jumped to some other wrong conclusion. So we see from the Upanishads that Maya is made of three gunas, that it is a misperception, a kind of magic, and that the universe is therefore apparitional, like the snake for which a rope has been mistaken. But why does the apparition take the form of this universe? Why do we see the physics that we see? Partly it is the gunas, and partly it is space and time. Partly it is the gunas, and partly it is space and time. Swami Vivekananda said in one of his lectures that the universe is the absolute, seen through the screen of time, space, and causation. He said that time, space, and causation are like the glass through which the absolute is seen, and when it is seen on the lower side, it appears on the universe. So not only is the universe apparitional, it is the absolute seen through time and space, and that allows us to understand why the physics of the universe takes the form that we see, remembering that physics is about how matter behaves. That's what physics is about. Now, Swami Vivekananda's statement that the universe is the absolute seen through the screen of time, space, and causation allows us to get some interesting information, albeit in negative terms, about what he calls the absolute. Since it is not in time, it cannot be changing. Change takes place only in time. And since it is not in space, it must be undivided because dividedness and separation occur only in space. And since it is therefore one and undivided, it must also be infinite, since there is no other to limit it. Very key to our understanding of the word infinite. Because the universe is one and undivided, it must be also be infinite, not finite, since there is no other to limit it. Now, changeless, infinite, and undivided are negative statements, but they will suffice. We can trace the physics of our universe from these three negative statements. But because of the revealing power, the changelessness, the infinitude, and the undividedness show through. But because of the revealing power, sattva, the changelessness, the infinitude, and the undividedness show through. What is apparitional causation? When you mistake a rope for a snake, the rope is not transformed into a snake. It is just a mistake, and it is something you're doing now. So the question is not, how did the absolute become the universe? That can't be answered. The absolute has not become the universe. The question is, why do I see it that way? Why do we feel that we are bound? Why do we continue to make this mistake? Why are we unable to see through this apparition? And that can be answered. On December 14th, 1882, Vijay Krishna Goswami asked Sri Ramakrishna this question. Sir, why are we bound like this? Why don't we see God? And Sri Ramakrishna answered, Maya is nothing but the egotism of the embodied soul. This egotism has covered everything like a veil. All troubles come to an end when the ego dies. If by the grace of God, a man can but once realize that he is not the doer, then he at once becomes a jivan mukta, a soul free while embodied, jivan mukta. then he at once becomes a Jivanmukta. Though living in the body, he is liberated. He has nothing to fear. So this brings up the question in John's mind as he proceeds, what is egotism? So Maya, the first cause, is made of three gunas and consists of seeing the absolute through the screen of time, space, and causation. And we can see, and we continue to see it thus because of egotism. What is this egotism? Those of you who have read Erwin Schrödinger's little book, What is Life?, may already see that egotism is a genetic invention to keep living organisms alive. Now, pay very close attention here, because this is truly the key to apparitional causation. It is so well explained. Those of you who have read Erwin Schrödinger's little book, What is Life?, may already see that egotism is a genetic invention to keep living organisms alive. Prime directives. The prime directives of the genetic programming are to breathe and to eat, and to pass on the genetic line. And the egotism required for the fulfillment of these prime directives is what Sri Ramakrishna referred to as the unripe ego. The discrimination is made between the organism and its environment for the sake of fulfilling these directives. We see ourselves as other in order to fulfill these prime directives, to eat, to breathe, and to pass on the genetic line. Sri Ramakrishna, when speaking to men, referred to these prime directives as woman and gold. Gold for directing a stream of negative entropy, I'll define that in a moment. To use the prime directives, he referred to the prime directives as woman and gold. Gold for directing a stream of negative entropy upon the organism, and woman for passing on the genetic line. When speaking to women, he said men and gold. He often said when speaking to men, Maya is nothing but woman and gold. Genetic programming. You remember that the question is not how the absolute has become the universe, but rather why do we continue to see it that way? And the answer is that because of egotism, And that egotism turns out to be nothing but our genetic programming. It is this genetic expectation that by following the dictates of the genes, we'll reach the peace and security of the changeless, the freedom of the infinite, and the bliss of the undivided. By following the dictates of genes, they promise, we'll reach the peace and security of the changeless, the freedom of the infinite, and the bliss of the undivided. But that is just a genetic mirage. This is why Swami Vivekananda referred to the world of our experience as a Tantalus's hell. If you remember the story of Tantalus, he was always reaching for that which he could not quite grasp. We get the word tantalizing in English from that. It's tantalizing. It attracts me, but I can't quite grasp it. It is this Tantalus's hell that he was speaking of that is this genetic mirage. Dobson again, so much for that problem. But how about our negative entropy? Negative entropy. We get our negative entropy by eating and breathing, and we get it from plants. Negative entropy is the tendency to stay alive and to become more complex. we think as entropy is as things falling apart, becoming less and less complex. Anti-entropy or negative entropy is the tendency to become more divided, more complex, more specialized. We get our negative entropy by eating and breathing, and we get it from the plants. The plants get their negative entropy from the sun. They make reducing agents for their own use and dump oxygen out as waste. We munch down the reducing agents and huff and puff on the oxygen and run around on the canned sunlight. We munch down the reducing agents, plants, and huff and puff on their oxygen and run around on the canned sunlight. And we feel that we are the doers. It's just a genetic mirage. We are not the doers. It's just recycled sunlight. That is, you see what I'm saying, how John gets right to it? We munch down the reducing agents and huff and puff on the oxygen and run around on the canned sunlight. And we feel that we are the doers. It's just a genetic mirage. We are not the doers. It's just recycled sunlight. Sometimes when you read in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna that he says we are not the doers, you might think that he is asking us to pretend that we are not the doers. No, he never makes that kind of mistake. He is not asking us to make believe anything. He is asking us to discriminate between the real and the make believe and to let the make believe go. How do we see this in the equations of Maya? We have talked a little bit about equations and a good bit about Maya. Now we have to take a hard look at our physics to see if any of our equations can be taken as descriptive of Maya. Relativity. In 1905, Einstein changed Einstein changed our geometry from 3D to 4D. He put time into our geometry where it belongs. Time and space come into the geometry as a pair of opposites, so that if the space separation and the time separation between two events, say here now and there then, are equal, the total separation between those two events is zero. This is Einstein's general theory of relativity. And that puts the separation between the perceiver and the perceived as zero, because always we see events away from us in space by the trick of seeing them back in time in just such a way that the total separation is zero. That separation equation, as I see it, is one of the equations of Maya. If this universe is apparitional, like a dream, then the separation between the dreamer and the dream must be zero. It was this change in the geometry that allowed Einstein to realize that what we see as mass, matter, is just potential energy, E equals mc squared. E equals m. The c squared is about how to get one from the other. So now we see that matter, mass, as well as energy, is just the underlying existence showing through in the apparition. So that equation, too, is an equation of Maya, energy and matter being the same, energy and mass, matter being the same. But there is another revolution that has taken place in our physics, which is considered even more basic than Einstein's change in our geometry. That is quantum mechanics. Matter does not behave according to our genetic expectations. These genetic expectations take for granted that space separations are real, and that causation is transformational rather than apparitional. There is this deep uncertainty, lying at the bottom of our quantum physics. In the late 1920s, Werner Heisenberg pointed out that the product of our necessary uncertainty in where a particle is and our necessary uncertainty in its momentum can never be smaller than Planck's constant over 2 pi. Now, we don't need to worry about the mathematics of that. frankly, to understand Planck's constant is in itself a year's study. I'm not fooling. And I have not done it. I have looked at the books and I have said, oh, no. But I will take John Dobson's assertion because he did understand it. Also, that the product of our necessary uncertainty in when something happens and our necessary uncertainty in the energy of that happening can never be less than the same amount. Uncertainty in when something happens and our necessary uncertainty about how much energy it takes to have that happening can never be less than the same amount. In other words, an equation, an equals sign. This is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which I take to be another of the equations of Maya. What it says is that if we see what we see through this time, what we see through the screen of time and space, we cannot quite tell what it is that we see. This is a nice summary of the uncertainty principle. What Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says is that if we see what we see through the screen of time and space, which we do, we cannot quite tell what it is that we see. Summary. These three equations, as I see it, are some of the equations of Maya. Einstein's separation equation sets the separation between the perceiver and the perceived at zero. The dream is in the dreamer. We see the bright star Sirius 8.5 light years away from us by the trick of seeing it 8.5 years ago. Einstein's more famous equation, E equals mc squared, in which energy is set equal to mass, is the equation which Swami Vivekananda had hoped to get from Nikola Tesla in 1895. He had this conversation, Vivekananda did, with Nikola Tesla in 1895 in New York City and asked him to prove by his mathematics that energy and mass were the same. Tesla didn't have time to do that because of what so he wrote to Einstein's wife about Swamiji's question and his request. In 1905, Albert Einstein, the husband, answered the question. Swami Vivekananda had hoped to get from Nikola Tesla this answer because, he said, there cannot be two existences, only one. And Heisenberg's uncertainty principle includes the notion that the observer is always mixed up in what he sees. And this is absolutely proven by something called the double slit experiment. I won't go into it. You can just Google it online. Double slit experiment. What you will discover there will completely upend your notion, your genetically programmed notion of Newtonian physics and Euclidean geometry that are part of what we've learned and been passed down through the genetic line. There cannot be two existences, only one. and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle includes the notion that the observer is always mixed up in what he sees. There is no longer any talk of a universe independent of the observer, any more than there is talk of an apparitional snake independent of the person who is seeing the apparition. Our problem is to reach the goal, to see beyond the screen. You remember that Swami Vivekananda said the universe is the absolute seen through the screen of space, time, and causation. It's no use asking how the absolute became the universe. The absolute has not become the universe any more than the rope has become the snake. Our problem is to see it straight. And you remember that Sri Ramakrishna said that Maya is nothing but the egotism of the embodied soul, and that is genetic. That is why we feel ourselves to be the doers of action and the enjoyers of its fruits. And it is just a genetic mirage. The genes have persuaded us that by following their dictates we'll reach the peace of the changeless, the freedom of the infinite, and the bliss of the undivided. They don't have it to give. We don't get the undivided. We get a family. You may have noticed. Our problem is to reach the goal. And by the way, John Dobson had a family. This was not him speaking in scorn or speaking from some ivory tower. A part of this that I wasn't able to go into, it is just too involved. It's called Counter-Cheating the Genes. If you choose to read it for yourself, you'll see his meditation on what it means to counter-cheat the genes. But the summary is, our problem is to reach the goal and not be hoodwinked by the genes. But this is not a journey from one place to another in an actual world. It is a journey from one point of view to another. That is why it is often referred to as an inner journey. It is a journey from the erroneous point of view dictated by the genes to the point of view from which we can see through the genetic mirage. How are we doing for time? Not bad. So now, having presented this wonderful talk that John wrote for the 1993 celebration, anniversary, 100th anniversary celebration of the Parliament of World Religions, and I encourage you, once you can find it online without our having posted it, but all you have to do is put in Dobson, the Equations of Maya. But if you want to wait till it's posted, I encourage you to read the whole thing. As a devotee, you will be, if the bhakta path is your own, as a devotee, you will be overwhelmed with awe and reverence. As a karmi, you will see, oh my God, this is exactly what Krishna was talking about in chapter 3 of the Gita. This is how not to see myself as the doer and the possessor of the fruits of my actions. As a Raja Yogi, is there material for your contemplation, concentration, and meditation. And of course, as a jnana, as a jnani, you will say, that's the key. That's it. And all I have to do is my manana nididhyasana, and I'll get there. So there's plenty of time for comments and questions, and please do be forthcoming. This is the best part. This is where the Sangha, the congregation, helps one another and enjoys one another as we hear what you have to say and what you think. Somebody go first. Ah, okay, there you are.
Yeah, so I was thinking Einstein's collapsing of space and time is an awful lot like what Eckhart Tolle talks about in his book Now, or what the Buddhists talk about when they're talking about mindfulness. It's just being, you know, present, so present that everything else vanishes, disappears.
Yes, very much. You know, the idea that there is something out there is as it's said, this is a necessary component of that genetic programming. Because otherwise, we'll stop breathing, we'll stop eating, and we won't be at all concerned about producing progeny. So this is one of the keys, the sense of separation is a trick to get us to play the game. And, you know, Holy Mother explains it in various places and in various ways. But as Swami Sarvapriyananda says, we have to admit we continue going on doing what we're doing because we like it. Okay. If we admit that clearly, we can get clearer and clearer about what we really like and what we don't like. And pretty soon we'll find that anything that is tantalizing is empty, as the Buddhists say. Yes, Paul.
I mean, that's a very beautiful talk and a wonderful article. So I really want to acknowledge that. You know, it's very profound, and I wonder something about when you there actually is a snake there, and you see it, and you think it's just a length of rope. And you step on it, and it bites you and kills you. I'm not sure how to reckon with that kind of an experience, with this paradigm that is in the stories.
Well, yeah, sure. There is this. There's this wonderful cartoon of this student standing in front of his master, his guru, and there's a snake attached to his fanny. And the student is saying, but you told me it was just a rope. No, to see clearly, it's like Sri Ramakrishna says, the study of consciousness will not make you unconscious. So you become more clear in your vision about what is rope and what is snake, not less clear. In spite of the cartoon, which is funny. It's really a great drawing if you can find it online. It's made its way around the internet through the social media, of course. But you said it was just a rope. Thank you, Paul. Yes, that is, we have to, we. It's not called walking the razor's edge for nothing. The straight is the way and narrow is the gate, as the Christians put it. So we can mistake a snake for a rope, for not, particularly if we get a little drunk. And drunk, you know, is metaphorical. That's why Sri Ramakrishna said, I drink no ordinary wine. My wine doesn't make me drunk. And Christ says in the Gospel of Thomas, you know, he just says, in the Gospel of the Beloved Companion, he says, when I arrived and saw the condition of the human beings, he said, I said to myself, oh, well, they're just drunk. They're just drunk on the experience of, he didn't use the word Maya, but that's what he meant. Anybody else? Yes.
To me, we got a different understanding about, I am not the doer.
Mm-hmm.
So, how the energy, it's just the energy just came in a different form. And how, as you mentioned, Krishna mentions it, you are not the doer, how the both these things coincide, and we really miss the thing. We always think that we are the doer, but it's still we get the energy from somewhere. We are just a tool.
We're part of the process.
Yes.
And yet we think we are the process.
We are the doer.
But it isn't as if we must suddenly say to ourselves, "Oh, well, I have to stop this." No, it's not stopping it. It's understanding it. That's why John went to such trouble. He was challenged to write this by Swami Swahananda. Swami Swahananda said, "You've been talking all these years about science and religion shaking hands. You do it." And so that's why John wrote this. Yes?
It's not a question, but the way I will put it, that thank you very much for presenting in 40 minutes in such a way. The reason is, I must think, because it has been placed in a seminar like that, it must be in a bigger thing. And you have taken the important parts, given your own interpretation of that, so that it came to us like hitting the heart.
Mm.
So the way you presented in 40 minutes, it's really awesome.
Mm.
And especially the way Sundar told that particular example, that we are eating, we are getting energy, but basically we are not relating it to the sun. It is very profound.
Yes.
From the scientific point of view, actually.
John Dobson had this series of 10 lectures that he gave every year in Hollywood when he was living there. And in one of them, he goes into some detail about what we're experiencing when we see a log burn. A log. We put a log on the fire, and the fire, it catches fire, it gets heated enough to where it ignites. What happens? He said the sunlight is released.
Yeah,
that's what we're feeling. The sunlight is stored in the log. It's stored in this complex mechanism. The sunlight is stored there. And he went on for maybe 12 minutes on the details of that. Just as he went on for 10 or 12 minutes about what happens if we just do the thought of experiment of a 10-gram marshmallow falling on the surface of a neutron star, what would happen? Enough energy would be released to vaporize a city from a 10-gram marshmallow. Lots of Maya. Yes, dear.
I recall some of the lectures. Personally, we are here when we spoke two or three times.
Mm.
And one of the things I vaguely recall is about the concept of neti-neti that he equated with the concept of space and time, the illusion that this is reality, whereas everything is in space and time. So he compared it with Vedantic concept of neti-neti, not this, not this.
Not space, not time.
Is beyond that space and time.
Yes.
So it's little bit I remember.
Yes, beautiful. John Dobson and Swami Yogeshananda were very good friends, as you probably know. And there is about three paragraphs in this talk, The Equations of Maya, in which he mentions Yogeshananda, and a letter he wrote to Yogeshananda explaining how it is not the earth that blooms a flower, that it is the entire universe that blooms a flower. And, thank you for noting that this was condensed into 40 minutes necessarily, but there are so much in the in the original article, so much. Just the explanation of how the universe blooms a flower is It's like I say, there's so much for a bhakta there. This explanation, it just reaches the heart.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Is it the same John Dobson for whom the Dobson telescope has been achieved?
The Dobson Mount, yes. He founded something called the Sidewalk Astronomers. And he made his goal was to make astronomy accessible to anyone. So he invented the Dobsonian Mount, which he said was nothing but the Civil War mortar mount. It was just nothing more than an adaptation of the mortar mount, the mount for the mortar cannons that was invented in the Civil War. He said, but you can make it so simply out of such simple products, and you can make your own telescope out of a porthole and a big cardboard tube, and you can see the galaxies, not just the moons of Jupiter. He would take people out to the desert, and he would tour the national parks with these beautiful homemade telescopes and give classes on astronomy, the Sidewalk Astronomers. You can look it up. It's quite an inspiring story. He's an amazing man.
Was it American Vedantics? American Vedantics had an article, probably, on John Dobson.
Oh, yes, there's been several articles over time on the Sidewalk Astronomers, John Dobson, and the American Vedantist. You can look it up online. Yes,
Lori? There's a great DVD on him.
Yes, yes. I think it is. I think it's called The Sidewalk Astronomer. If you just Google John Dobson, you know, there's a lot there. For example, you'll find on YouTube his appearances on Johnny Carson, which were just hilarious. You know, you caught little glimpses of his humor here. You know, this remark, you don't get this, you get a family, you may have noticed. Just lots of that kind of thing. And he had Johnny Carson just in stitches. And he says in the article, in the talk, he says, I was on Johnny Carson and I got to Thomas and Rajas, but I didn't even get to Satra because the audience was howling. It was, and so after that, then the music plays and they go to a commercial. So, Dobson's worth your time, is what I'm saying.
I want to ask you, what was that you said? Counter-cheat the genes?
Counter-cheating the genes, yes. And he describes a strategy for it. Of course, it involves spiritual discipline, spiritual practice. But, basically, it's a thought experiment in the beginning. You know, understanding the genes and how they're working in us to create this confusion that we are the doer when we're nothing but a mechanism running on canned sunlight.
Tonight you will have 11, Super Bowl.
Yes, lots of people running around on canned sunlight and other chemicals. Anyone else? Well, as I left the building, the monastery, I noticed that some dishes had been brought that were smelling very interesting indeed from the point of view of genetic programming. So as you know, that's our next part of this program, is to enjoy one another's company over some snacks, and I think more than just snacks in these cases, and tea and coffee as you wish. So if there's nothing else from anyone, yes, Lori?
Just to mention that today is Swami Yogeshananda's 96th birthday.
Swami Yogeshananda, the founder of this place, now lives at the Tribhuco Monastery, and he turned 96 today, yes, February 3rd. Many, many auspicious things about this day.
Sham is right there with him.
Oh, Sham, many of you know Sham Pindarkar. So is Sanjeev Gupta. Sanjeev Gupta is also with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, they flew out to Orange County to celebrate the Swami's birthday with him.
Now he looks like...
Swami is not well. Swami Yogeshananda is not well. His mind is still sharp. I asked him when he was here in 2013 for the July 4th celebration here. That was his last visit here. I asked him what it is that he lives for now. And he answered in one word, meditation. So his body is coming to pieces, but his mind remains strong. And that's... But if you send him an email, he has a dear devoted friend, devotee, a Hispanic fellow that is part of the congregation there, who reads his emails to him, and then the Swami dictates his response, and the fellow. So if you send him an email, you'll receive a response. It's very hard for him to talk on the telephone, so probably best not to do that. Yes, Lori?
Also, his email is yogeshananda@vedanta.org.
Yeah, yogeshananda@vedanta.org. Just that, and you can get a sweet response from him. He very much likes to have people contact him. And this is his translation of our closing prayer. It's an ancient prayer for peace that we repeat together. May there be peace in outer space. Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. May this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Yes. And if that actually obtains, it will be the equilibrium of the gunas that Swami Vivekananda talked to, and all apparition will disappear. Peace, peace, peace. So thank you so very much for coming. Please do go inside. I'll be along in just a minute after I finish tidying up here.